We have said thus far this week that everybody has the basis of authority. For the evangelical, the central part of that basis is the Bible, not exclusively, but centrally. And we looked yesterday at some of the positive proofs, claims that the Bible makes for itself, because this is only fair and proper, that the Scriptures should be allowed to speak for themselves. Now, if you get so far with a person as to suggest that the Bible is God's message, reliably recorded in words and without error, then very likely one of the principal objections that a person will bring against the Bible is related to the whole subject of miracles. They may pick on Jonah, or they may pick on some miracle in the gospel, in the Gospels, or they may pick upon the resurrection. Or they may pick on the one we're going to pick on today, the matter of creation. But miracles will be the big area which will be debated, because if a person does not accept a basis of authority which includes the supernatural, theism, Bible, however you want to put it, then of course he's going to object to the whole concept of the miraculous. And you will also notice that the reverse is true. If a person starts to defect from the faith, it very often is in the area of his belief about the Bible, and very particularly the miracles of the Scriptures. But the subject of the miracle of creation of the world and of life and of man is one that is very much picked on today, and that's why I chose to include it in these five lessons that we have this week. Now, there are three positions you can take with regard to the subject of creation or evolution. One, you can believe in the pure creationist viewpoint. And I say pure because I want to distinguish it rather sharply. That is, you can believe that creation is to be taken pretty much at face value, very much at face value, as it is recorded in the Scriptures. And that's what I want to call a more or less pure creationist viewpoint. Second, you can take a pure evolutionary viewpoint on the subject. And again, I'd like to put these rather in sharp contrast. And you can hold to a thoroughgoing evolution. That is, that what we see today is the result of natural processes taking place over a long period of time to produce all that is in evidence today in the world and in man around us. Or you can take a third viewpoint, which is an attempt to bring the other two together, and it is generally called theistic evolution. That is, that God is in the picture, that's the theistic part, but evolution was the principal, if not only means, well, it wouldn't be only, but it was the principal means which God used to bring about what we see today. Theistic evolution makes evolution the major explanation for what happened, and where we cannot explain things by evolution, God gets into the picture and bridges the unanswerable gaps which evolution leaves in its theory. Now, an awful lot of Christians are theistic evolutionists, and I recognize these are believers, many of them. But I want to make it clear to you that the evolutionist doesn't accept theistic evolution. He thinks it's a lot of nonsense, because he recognizes that if evolution can do what it claims to have done, you do not need God in the picture. And he also recognizes, on the other hand, that if God is in the picture, you don't need evolution. And he recognizes theistic evolution for what it is, a compromise, a hybrid, either part of which would be sufficient alone to explain things. God is sufficient alone to explain what we see, and evolution, they claim, is sufficient alone to explain what we see. So it's really only the Christian who holds to theistic evolution. The evolutionist doesn't have any use for it, because he recognizes that the viewpoint is not necessary. If evolution can do what it can do, then it has done. And if God can do what the Christian says he can do, then you don't need evolution. Now, a lot of people in supporting theistic evolution argue this way. They say, but couldn't God have used evolution? And the answer to that question is yes, God could have. But that's not the question. The question to be debated is, did God use evolution? Not could he have? And the only answer to that, the only proper answer to that, is in the Scriptures. So don't anybody push you in a corner by saying, well, don't you believe God could have used evolution? He could have started it all and then used evolution? Well, of course. But that's not the question. The question is, did he do it that way? And that's the answer that you're seeking. You're not seeking the possibility, the various possibilities that God might have used to do something. Quite possible God could have done it without evolution, too. But they never debate that question. Yeah, they always want to get evolution in the picture some way, somehow. Now, the word evolution is a perfectly proper word. You can use it in a very proper sense. And the fact that it has a basic meaning which can be used properly or which can be used improperly leads to some confusion. It's like the word gamble. Boy, really, it's quite a gamble to drive on the streets today, isn't it? And that's a perfectly proper use of the word gamble. I came out here this afternoon and I really took a chance just driving. It's a gamble to drive on the streets today. That's true. But that's a fairly general use of the word gamble and doesn't make me a gambler in your mind. If you want to apply the noun gambler to me, you think of Las Vegas or Reno or something like that and you think of another use of the word gambling. Now, in the analogy, listen, it's perfectly proper to talk about the evolution of the Ford automobile from the Model T to the LTD. And you mean the change that's taken place in Ford cars over the years. For evolution means change. But it's quite another thing. And by the way, if I say that, if I say there's been quite an evolution in the Ford car or in the field of communications or whatever, that doesn't make me an evolutionist, does it? Just because I said that. Any more than if I say it's a gamble to drive your car on the streets today, it doesn't make me a gambler. But it's quite another thing to use the word evolution as the theory uses it, and that is to include the whole production of things as we see them today through natural processes. That's the theory of evolution. And that's quite a different thing. We're not just talking about changes. We all see changes. But that's not the sole substance of the theory of evolution. We're talking about origins and development of new things as well as changes in existing things. Now, the evolutionist has a real advantage here with the word evolution and with the idea of change because everybody admits there's been change in the world. And you can see it all the time. You can see changes within species. You can see changes in social structures. You can see changes in physical things, mechanical things. And we all admit that there are changes. Now, what the evolutionist does is he tries to get you to think that because you can observe small changes within certain spheres, that this really proves that there have been the big changes necessary for evolution to have produced what we see on the earth today. The small is projected in your mind into the large. And because you admit the presence of small changes, the evolutionist presses that point and says, but then it's a very simple thing to assume that there have been these large changes. And it's not quite so simple as that. Now, the first point on the outline is evolution reasonable? And I want to talk first of all about mutations and natural selection, which has to do with these large changes, which are necessary if evolution did account for and does account for you and the world around you as it exists today. Mutations and natural selection, please remember, are the means of evolution, the only means of evolution. Fossils are not the means of evolution. They are the supposed picture, evidence of evolution. But they don't tell you how. The means, the how, the mechanism, the way it happens is limited to the one thing, two things, mutations and natural selection. This is how it happened. This is evolutionist explanation for how this all occurred. And this is the only means. There's no other means except mutations and natural selection. You think I'm saying too much? Here is what Huxley says about mutations and natural selection. Not only is it an effective agency of evolution, but it is the only effective agency of evolution. So this is the only explanation for how evolution occurred. Now, this is what it means. A mutation is a variation within some existing substance or form. The most common mutation you would know something about, perhaps, would be variations that come in the human body when a baby is born with a mutation. A common mutation is something like a sixth finger sticking off the side of a person's hand when a child is born. And this is due to a mutation. It's a change, a variation, in an existing thing, a hand. Sometimes there are mutations which are more serious and damaging to the human body. I grew up in the town where there lived the tallest man on medical record, Robert Wadlow. And he's a little older than I was, but I can remember getting on the bus and he would be on there because he lived a little further up the line than we did. And he would always be sitting in the seat behind the driver with his legs sticking out on the steps of the door across the aisle of the bus. And this is the only way he could ride a bus. Now, he was unfortunately a mutant. And he had something wrong that caused this abnormal growth. You'd think he'd be a great basketball player, but he wasn't. Because mutations usually make the organism weaker, not better. And that's a very important point. And with all of his height, he did not have any coordination. So he wasn't a good player. And furthermore, the physical weakness he had was extreme sensitivity to infection. And a scratch would put him in bed because he had no resistance. In fact, that's what killed him. He scratched himself somewhere on his leg or foot, as I recall. And eventually, the simple infection that you and I would have thrown off without even stopping killed him. Now, a mutation is a variation, a change in an existing form. Natural selection means that nature will select out and preserve and pass on to subsequent generations those forms which are beneficial. Now evolution says this is how it happened. A mutation occurred. It seemed to make our pre-ancestor better, and so natural selection preserved that one and let the others die out, and then he produced others like him, and another mutation occurred, and this was preserved by natural selection, and pretty soon we had enough of this happening over enough period of time so that we developed up the long road of evolution from the original things to the more developed things to somebody that could breathe air and so on and so on and so on. And all this is through mutations and natural selection. And that seems very reasonable. Very reasonable. Because we do see mutations. But we don't see natural selection preserving the better form if the better form is weaker, if the mutant is weaker, which it is. Then it wouldn't be preserved because being weaker, it would die out. And natural selection wouldn't select it because it wouldn't survive. But we do see mutations occurring, and therefore it seems reasonable that if somebody could grow a sixth finger, that this might be more advantageous, and therefore six-fingered people would be preserved by natural selection. Pretty soon we all have six fingers. Now, that's not such a fanciful illustration. I read a couple of summers ago, there was a big push by geneticists, apparently, in this country. And they got an awful lot of publicity. And one of the leading geneticists in the land was talking about six fingers. And I read this in the News or the Herald, I forget which one. And he was talking about the advantage of having six-fingered hands in a computer age. And he said he hoped his children would have six fingers. because they would be at an advantage over other people. This would be a slight but nonetheless real upward step in the ladder of evolution. All right, let's follow that through a moment. Suppose you were born with six fingers. On both hands, let's give you a real advantage. Both hands have six fingers. Now, mind you, usually it's going to stick out like this. That's the way it occurs. It isn't nice and neat up here. It's usually a appendix sticking off like that. But suppose you had that in both hands. We won't wait for the years to occur until you get them in both hands. We'll give them to you in both hands right now. And this is going to give you a super edge on everybody in life. Well, now let's think. Would it? Would it? How about typing a term paper? Or how about playing the piano, guitar? Or it might help you holding the ball, I'm not sure. Big enough ball it might, small enough. If that were sticking out like that, that'd sure ruin your pitching. And I don't think it'd give you a great advantage. Especially in a five-fingered civilization. Now, natural selection is geared to five fingers, not six. So even if you did live with that mutation, presumably natural selection would breed you out because you would be weaker. Now, that's such a little thing that it's hardly worth talking about. But let's project it to something bigger. If evolution occurred, that's how it had to occur. All right, let's start back with the time when our ancestors had no circulatory system, no nervous system, no seeing system, no hearing system, no nervous system. And to produce these things, how many mutations would have to take place? To produce an eye, let's say, and the tear duct, and the lashes, and the slit, and all the rest of the things that are in the eye that I don't know anything about. And a nervous system, not one nerve somewhere, but all the linkage with the brain. And a circulatory system. Suppose the mutation first produced a heart without any arteries. What would happen to the heart? It would be useless, and natural selection would cause it to die out. Suppose the first mutation produced the arteries without the heart. What good would they be? Now, my point is, young people, that mutations can't occur back here and then a million years later, another one, and 1,000 years later, another one, and 1,000 years later, another one, or even 10 years later, 20 years later, another one. Because in the meantime, the first one, which you need in combination with the others, would have died out. Now the answer to that by the evolutionists, by some evolutionists, is that there occurred bursts of mutation. They recognize the force of this. And some of them are saying that there occurred bursts of mutation. All at once, it happened. So that there could be enough at the same moment to produce a whole seeing system in a body, or a whole circulatory system, or a whole nervous system, instead of one accidental mutation there, and another accidental one here, an accidental one here. Of course, the first one long died out. Suppose the first accidental mutation had been the tear duct. And here, suddenly, you got nothing up here, no brow, no lashes, no slit, no eye back there, but you got a tear duct. And the tear's got no place to go except down here, because there's no eye, no opening. So you spend all your life that way. Now, natural selection would say that's useless, so it would breed it out. You see, you need the tear duct when you get the rest of it. And you need it. You need all this pretty much at the same time, or else the eye wouldn't survive. And evolution can't say an accidental one here, and then 100 years later another accidental one, 100 accidental ones, because in the meantime, the first one would have died out, and you need all of them together. So some of them are saying that these mutations happened in a burst. Isn't that wonderful that that happened by chance? So miraculous. Can't use that word. So accidentally, by chance, this happened so accidentally, so that all of them were just at the right time and the right place and the right person, and they were suddenly all preserved, so that the rest of us could take this next step up in the ladder of evolution. That's how it had to be. Now, please remember, this is the only explanation for evolution. Only by mutation and natural selection could this have occurred. Now, listen to this. If the mutation rate were one, is that showing up? In 100,000. And if the occurrence of each mutation doubled the chance of another mutation occurring in the same cell, the probability of 5 simultaneous mutations altogether occurring in any one individual would be 0.22 zeros, 1, or 1 times 10 to the 22nd power. That means that if the population averaged 100 million individuals, and if every generation lasted one day, every day you got 100 million new individuals, that's the chances of 5 mutations appearing one time would not be expected to happen except once every 247 billion years. Now that stacks the odds pretty high against evolution occurring. But all we asked was for 5 simultaneous things to happen. How many do you suppose it takes to make an eye, a circulatory system, a nervous system? All we need is 5 happening. If you had 100 million people living every day and you're changing a new 100 million the next day, then the chances of this happening to one person in all that billions and billions and billions of people who keep flowing across the scene of the world would be once every 247 billion years. And how old is man supposed to be on this earth? How old is the earth supposed to be, according to evolution? About 5 billion, the earth. And the ancestors of men, about the first life, let's say that, the first life, maybe 2 billion years ago. And it would take 247 billion years to go by before, by chance, you could get one of these sets of 5 occurring. But that's how it happened, according to evolution. So, if you want to write a formula, the evolutionist says evolution occurred by mutations and natural selection and time. Mutations, natural selection, and time. I guess I can make that formula a little bit better, couldn't I? Mutations plus natural selection times time. That'd be better. Okay? That's how it occurred. Mutation plus natural selection times a lot of time, and that gave us what we are, see, and have in the world today. All right. Now, there's lots more to be said, but do you understand that? Because that's really basic and essential to the whole subject, because that's how it supposedly happened. And there's no other way that it could have happened except mutations and natural selection. Now, the second thing I have indicated on the outline is something about a second law of thermodynamics. And briefly, simply as I can say it, it has to do with this. The second law says that the energy in the universe remains constant, but the amount of useful energy is decreasing, getting smaller. Or very popularly, the second law says that usefulness is less and less, uselessness is increasing. And sometimes it's put this way, the universe is running down. That doesn't really isn't quite accurate, because the energy is staying the same, but the usefulness of it is running down. And that's what the second law supposedly teaches. And it's supposed to be an undebatable law of physics, but it's absolutely contrary to what evolution is saying. Because evolution is saying that usefulness is increasing, not decreasing. And there's a real contradiction between what they say in one science and what they say in another science. Now, I heard a panel talk about this one time, and somebody brought up this question. And the scientist on the panel just said this. He was here in Dallas. He just said, yes, but evolution is an exception to the second law of thermodynamics. Well, that's nice. As a matter of fact, it's not just an exception. I mean, evolution is the whole story. if it's an exception, it's a very big exception. Because evolution accounts for everything, in their view. And if this is an exception, it's a big exception. And that was his answer. The more scholarly answer would be to say that solar energy, energy from the sun, bursts into this world and reverses the running down. Gives a burst like charging a battery. In other words, your battery runs down and solar energy coming into our system recharges it. Now, that's really the more scholarly answer, and usually the answer you hear. But what they forget to tell you is that in order for solar energy to do that, there has to be some mechanism in the receiver which will take the charge. I'm going to use the illustration as simply as I can. I tried to charge a battery some time ago, and I borrowed a friend's battery charger, and I put the thing on, and it started the next morning, and the next night it was dead. And after I did that a few times, I got the thing tested, and the man said, it won't take a charge. Well, all the elements were there. I hadn't done one thing to that battery. I hadn't removed anything. Everything was there, but it won't take a charge. Now, the battery had run down. And the second law of thermodynamics says that the world is useful energy is running down, getting less and less available. But the evolution says solar energy comes in and will recharge it. But they forget to tell you that there's nothing in the receiver here that will take that charge. Now, you think I'm making that up? I read you what an evolutionist says about this. How, this is his question to himself, how, when no life existed, did substances come into being which today are necessary to living systems, but which can only be formed by living systems? In other words, how did something come which is necessary and which can only be formed by it, but which wasn't in existence to be formed by it? And what he's really saying is, how could this solar energy have triggered something when there was no response, no mechanism in the receiver that would accept the trigger? And the answer is, it couldn't happen. And really, the argument about the second law of thermodynamics is a very serious one to the evolutionist, only he refuses to face it. He will just take refuge in an exception or in somehow the miracle, can't use that word, somehow the chance effect of solar energy on something which it is never known to affect otherwise. Now, I want to say something about fossils. Are you still with me? Fossils are not the way. They don't tell you about how it happened. They just picture what supposedly happened. Fossils are supposed to be the evidence for evolution. But they really don't explain it like mutations and natural selection do. But fossils are supposed to picture how evolution occurred. And the fossil evidence is supposed to show you the progression from simple to more complex. And make you think that this happened in every area, including man himself. Now, there are lots and lots and lots of fossils. So the data is plentiful. We're not talking about 10 or 20 pieces of evidence. We're talking about millions of pieces of evidence. I remember being in the Middle East and getting on a bus, and here comes a little kid selling fossils. I wish I'd have bought a dozen. I didn't buy any. They were beautifully done. He'd cut the rock about so big, and he polished the fossil, and it just was there like somebody had printed it there almost. And 25 cents. I wish I'd bought a multitude of them. But at any rate, there's just lots and lots and lots and lots of fossils. We're not talking about a scanty bit of evidence. Now, the fossils are supposed to line up from simplest in the oldest layers to more complex in the younger layers of rock in the earth. And this is supposed to show you that evolution occurred. Now here are a few questions about fossil evidence. Numerous places around the world, the simpler fossils have been deposited in layers above those containing more complex fossils. One famous area of this type is in Glacier National Park in this country, where there's a big block of early limestone, supposed to be a billion years old, found resting on top of a more recent layer that's supposed to be only 100 million years old. Now, the evolutionists recognize there are such places in the world, but their answer is it's just a freak, and not to be an exception, not to be considered. The remarkable thing about this one is that this block of limestone is about 350 miles long, 35 miles wide, and 6 miles thick. And having every appearance of being laid down in normal processes on top of the supposedly younger rock that's underneath it. So that's a mighty big exception. It would have taken a big something to make that kind of upset, upheaval, in such a large chunk. To me, the most serious thing about the fossil evidence, from the evolutionist standpoint, is the fact that it's a circular argument. Now listen, how do you date the layer of the rock? By the fossil. How do you date the fossil? By the layer it's found in. Exactly the way it's done. And it is a circular argument. The Encyclopedia Britannica, which can hardly be accused of being creationist in its viewpoint, says, it cannot be denied that from a strictly philosophical standpoint, geologists are arguing in a circle. The succession of organisms, that is, simple to complex, has been determined by a study of the remains buried in the rocks, and the relative ages of the rocks are determined by the remains that they contain. That's just beautiful circular reasoning. Date the fossil by the layer it's in, date the layer by the kind of fossil it contains. Now, my wife, who has more nerve than I had would have about this, was seated next to a geologist one night at a banquet, and so she asked him this question, how come? He said, well, that's just a theoretical matter. Well, she said, it seems rather obvious to me. And he said, well, we have other ways of breaking the circle. His wife, who was also a geologist, was sitting next to him, and she said, well, it is a circular argument. And she was more willing to admit it. But he said, we got other ways of breaking the circle. Well, what are the ways of breaking the circle? Oh, the certain ways of dating we have. That's how we do it. Carbon-14. Who hasn't heard of radiocarbon dating? And we know that can date these things. And if that can't, then potassium-argon dating can do it. Or something can surely date these remains so that we have clear evidence of their being hundreds of millions of years old. Do we? Well, that's not so certain. Carbon dating is reliable, maybe with real reliability, only 5 or 6 or 8,000 years. Even the discoverer of the carbon dating, Libby, says it's no more reliable than 12 or 14,000 years. Now, 14,000 years isn't 100 million years by a long shot. And these other methods of dating, neither can they date back that far. It is impossible. And the results that are gotten by some of these methods are so contradictory. In fact, I was at a conference one time, and I introduced myself last winter. And the fellow says, I work for the state of California. And I said, what do you do? And he said, I work in the dating laboratory. We date specimens from around the state. And I said, well, how do you get these old dates? He says, well, we try, and if it doesn't come out the way we think it ought to, we try again. And if it doesn't come out, we try 3 or 4 times, and when we get a date that seems like it's reasonable, then we accept that one and publish those conclusions. Now, he was not arguing, he was arguing for his own method, and he was arguing for evolution. And I was aghast to think that anybody would admit that, but that's what he admitted. And I've discovered since that's a pretty normal, standard operating procedure. Do it 3 or 4 times until you get what you think you ought to get, and then publish that one, and don't publish the contradictory datings. Now, of course, all these datings are based upon the assumption that the rate of change in the element that you're using has been constant. If there's been any difference, if the clock was slowed down or speeded up 5 or 10 or 15,000 years ago, then the dating method is thereby affected. And they're all based upon a uniform change, rate of change, by which the measurement can be taken. And if it hasn't been uniform, which it probably hasn't, then the method is no good. Or at least it's out of adjustment that much. So you really don't break the circle. It's still a circular argument. Now everybody is concerned about dinosaurs when you talk about fossils. I don't know why, but they are. And as far as I can see, dinosaurs existed on the earth before the flood, and two of that species, whether the dinosaur itself or some other member of that species, was taken into the ark, and when they came out of the ark, they did not survive. They became extinct. Now, you think of a dinosaur and you think of the biggest thing you can think of, but all dinosaurs aren't that big. There's a place down here in Glen Rose, Texas, where there are dinosaur tracks, and some of them are no bigger than that. The hoof of the dinosaur, or whatever you call the dinosaur's foot, is no bigger than that. So all varieties of dinosaurs aren't the huge animals that you think of, and could easily have been taken into the ark. When they came out, they didn't survive. Now I think the reason they didn't survive is that the climate had so drastically changed that they couldn't survive. You see, you find dinosaur remains all over the world. They're not limited to one climate zone. And this is a very big problem for the evolutionists. If such an animal did exist, now just take it from the evolutionist viewpoint, if he did exist, and if he roamed the whole earth, way up in the north you find him in Alaska, down here in Glen Rose, Texas, where it's pretty hot today. If such an animal did roam the earth, then why in the world would he ever become extinct? A creature of that size. Who would put him out of commission? Would natural selection preserve him? I think the only explanation is that climate changed drastically after the flood and he couldn't survive. And the two that came out of the ark, and the others were buried in the flood. And that's why you find remains of dinosaurs all over the earth, because they apparently roamed the earth. But they're no problem, really, any more than any other animal that's become extinct since the time of the flood. Now, I wanted to say something about faith and time, because time is essential to evolution. Otherwise, there's no way to account for it. And faith is essential to evolution. Otherwise, you wouldn't receive it as a system. Listen to this. Here's a famous anthropologist. In The Nature of Things, speaking about the origin of the horse, the hypothesis I've just proposed cannot be ruled out categorically, and some respectable scientists support it. Nevertheless, it is so improbable as to be unacceptable unless we find no hypothesis more likely to explain the facts. And of course, he wouldn't accept creation. Or, here's another one. Now listen to the faith of this man. No one would bet on anything so improbable happening, yet it has happened. It has happened thanks to the workings of natural selection and the properties of living substance which make natural selection inevitable. That's Huxley. Or listen to this one. How vertebrates came from invertebrates. All this is complicated, obscure, and dubious. Anyway, there evolved from the invertebrates a tribe of animals which, by hook or by crook, acquired backbones. Now, what I say to you is that takes faith. And don't let anybody ever challenge you because you have faith. Every system has faith in it. Remember? Day one, and on Monday, they all have elements of faith. And evolution is no exception. It takes a great deal of faith to believe that evolution happened. So the question really boils down to, where is your faith placed? In this kind of system? Or in the Bible and the God whom it reveals? Now, I haven't said everything, of course, about this subject, but maybe that's enough to show you where the system is, what its strong points are, what its major emphases are, and help you to attack those major places, because that's the place we ought to attack evolution. If somebody comes to you and says, well, what about such and such a thing that seems to have developed? Don't debate that. Knock at the base of the statue, mutations and natural selection. Knock at the fossil evidence. We don't have any fossils of these transitional forms. How come? Billions of fossils and not one of the change of the transitional forms. Not one. This is the place at which to attack. Okay, I hope that gives you some help on this subject. Come back at 3 o'clock. I think that's the next thing I'm supposed to say. I don't know.